The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. The information and ideas presented on this show are for informational purposes only. Please consult a business continuity, security, or disaster recovery professional before implementing any plans or ideas discussed on this show. The implementation of any protocol is at the sole discretion and responsibility of our listeners.
Is your business ready for a disaster, or are you prepared for anything? No matter the industry or structure of your organization, chances are there could be room for improvement regarding your survival business practices. This is Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. Your host is Pamela Hill. Join us today as we study what's working in business preparedness and what's still left to do. Here is Pamela Hill.
Hello and welcome to the show, everyone. This is Pam Hill, your host, and this is Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. Well, 20 or 30 years ago, who would have ever thought that business executives would need to be trained to understand what motivates a person to commit targeted violence? But yet, here we are grappling across the nation with this very issue. Recognizing the signs and understanding the motivations of a would-be attacker is critical to mitigating the risk of workplace violence. So today we're going to talk about this fascinating and scary topic with an expert in the field, Mike Roach, the author of Mass Killers, How You Can Identify Workplace, School, or Public Killers Before They Strike. Mike Roach has over three decades of law enforcement experience. He began his career with the Little Rock, Arkansas Police Department and spent 22 years with the U.S. Secret Service. The last 15 years of his career were focused on conducting behavioral threat assessments of those threatening to engage in targeted violence. Mike is also assigned to the intelligence liaison to the FBI and CIA headquarters, as well as being assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which we could do a whole show on to itself. He's an author of three novels, a nonfiction work on rapport building, and the book we are discussing today on mass killers. Now retired, Mike is currently a security consultant at Protective Threat LLC and an adjunct instructor at St. Leo University. So welcome to the show today, Mike.
Well, thank you so much, Pam. It's a pleasure to be on here with you.
Really, really happy that you're here. I think this is going to be a fascinating topic. And you know, like you and I were talking about, instead of really talking about the threat assessment side of this, I've done a couple of shows on this. I really like to talk about the people that actually commit the targeted violence, kind of what makes them tick. But first, I'm kind of curious about trends. Is this targeted violence a new phenomenon, or has this been around for a while?
No, it has been around for a considerable period of time. And you can go back to I remember in the 1920s, like 1927, I believe it was, Andrew Kehoe in Bath, Michigan, killed 38 children in an attack in Michigan. And then Howard Unruh in 1949 in Camden, he had a list of grudges and went on a shooting spree in Camden, New Jersey, and landed up killing 13. But, you know, you can move forward. There was some more significant ones over the recent times that people, most of the viewers might be familiar with, and that being in the mid-60s, Whitman was the shooter at the Texas clock tower. And he was quite an interesting case because here was an individual that was, you know, by all appearances, the all-American boy. He was a former altar server, piano player, U.S. Marine, was attending the University of Texas, was married. And, you know, from all appearances, you would think he was, you know, a stable individual, but there was significant issues in his background. And despite a genius IQ, decided to kill his wife, his mother, and then climb up the steps to the clock tower and killed additional 18 individuals. So, you know, it's not new. And then you can throw in the St. Ysidro shooting at the McDonald's by John Huberty and the Lubies shooting where George Henard drove his pickup truck into the restaurant with all the shocked diners initially coming to his aid thinking that it was an accident. Then he gets out and kills 24 people. So, you know, it's been going on for a period of time. It's just that, you know, now we're seeing probably a higher concentration of them occurring, and of course with the news media.
Right. So do you think there are more mass killings now or events of targeted violence, or are they just getting more press?
Well, you know, the old analogy in the newsroom is if it bleeds, it leads. And, you know, with this 24/7 news cycle, you know, with the advent of CNN and Fox News and MSNBC, you know, these news media outlets are constantly striving to, you know, get the news in front of their viewers, keep them refreshed, keep them in front of the TV for advertising. And then you throw in, you know, Twitter and Facebook on top of that, and the significant media platform now. And so, yeah, I would say that, you know, you're garnering a lot more attention over the past. But as far as an actual increase, you know, that's been disputed. And, you know, recently USA Today analyzed the trends from the FBI. And what they discovered was that the accuracy rate of reporting to the FBI was only around 61%. And, you know, because, you know, police departments have to voluntarily report this data. And then you have to look at, well, what's the definition of a mass killing? And for the FBI, it's, you know, four or more victims at a single location. So, you know, some, for example, the shooting at the mall up in Montgomery County, or the Columbia Mall, over the weekend, that wouldn't be classified as a mass killing because there were two victims that were killed and then the third being the shooter himself. So that wouldn't count as a mass killing. And we have a lot of those where perhaps there's only one or two victims, but the mindset may have been that they were intending to cause a lot greater murder and mayhem. And now, Texas State University did a recent study, and I thought this was interesting. This was looking at active shooters, and what they found was that, you know, from like 2000 to about 2008, most of the active shooter incidents across the U.S. ran around 5 or 6, and typically below 10. And then all of a sudden in 2009, that there was a significant uptick to like 15, and then in 2010 there were 20 incidents of active shooters. So, you know, there is an incident, an uptick, in my opinion, but the, you know, some people will argue whether it is or is not. And the bottom line is you're looking at mass murderers representing approximately 1% of all homicides that occur across the U.S.
Right. And what's interesting to me is how the press handles these, because they're like, well, only two people died, you know, but we're going to give this one, you know, more media attention because of the fact that, you know, 24 people were, you know, were killed. It's kind of like they play into it. And I don't know, you may not know this, so I apologize for asking it on the fly, but have they ever done any studies of whether there's an uptick after, you know, like a Columbine, obviously, or the school shooting in Connecticut? Are there increases immediately following that because the press is out, that's all they're talking about? I was always kind of curious if there was a tie to the crazies coming out of the woodwork. Sorry, that was me that said that, not you, by the way. The crazies coming out of the woodwork after that, when, you know, they're kind of wanting to get into the press.
You know, I think there's always been discussion of copycats, and I'm sure someone has conducted that research. In fact, I've thought about that myself, you know, wondering in fact, is there actually an increase of incidence after one? And, you know, there have been some instances where you'll see shortly thereafter there's, well, here's another one, and there's another one. And what I would believe is that most of these individuals were already contemplating violence, and they were on the road, and then this was perhaps the final catalyst to sit there and say, well, look at, he was able to do it, or she was able to do it, and look at all the media exposure that they garnered from it. You know, now it's my turn in the sun, so to speak. And so I think there probably is a correlation, but I don't know that that's been researched and documented to this point in time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Do you think that, so we know that we're not actually sure if these have increased in number, but what about lethality? You know, are we more lethal now with the types of weapons that are available? And this is not a show about gun control.
Right, right.
I'm just kind of curious. It just,
yeah, those are weeds we probably don't want to trace off.
Yeah, let's not. No, not on this one.
It's a very polarizing issue, and yeah, you'll never get agreement on it. So I always try to stay away from that that discussion.
So what about the increase in lethality?
I'm sorry, the increase in lethality.
When people go out with guns now, are they more lethal with them, basically? Are they more trained with the weapons? You know, we may not be killing 20 or 30 people, but, the basic shots have improved to the point that, you know, that when they shoot, they're likely to hit their target.
You know, the one thing that I, you know, there's a lot of discussion concerning the video games. And the one thing I will say about video games is that it becomes essentially a virtual training component for them. And somebody is able to, you know, subject themselves to acquiring targets, shooting, reloading, and firing. And, you know, Dave Grossman, who's a former West Point professor and has wrote the fabulous book On Killing, speaks of specifically one case in Paducah, Kentucky with Michael Carneal. And Michael Carneal had never fired a weapon but had played hours of video games and was able to go into a school, into his school in Paducah, Kentucky. And there was a church group that was, or a prayer group that was breaking up, and he fired at them. And I don't remember the exact numbers now, but I want to say it was, regardless of the numbers of students he shot, and it may have been six, but he had 100% success rate of shooting, where if you look at police officers involved in shootings, the success rate of actually hitting their target is somewhere around 20%. So here's a kid that really has never fired a gun before outside of video games, is able to go in and shoot 6-on-6. And,
wow.
100%, yeah.
That's really something. Mike, we have to go to break now, but when we come back, I want to dig into this topic just a little bit more, because I think this is really interesting. It's actually one of the reasons why I wanted to do this show today, besides to have you on, of course. So this is Pam Hill. This is Fear is Negotiable, and I'm here with the wonderful Mike Roach, and we'll be right back.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet? Why not? Just go to facebook.com/World Talk Radio or search for the keywords World Talk Radio. Once you're a part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the World Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to facebook.com/World Talk Radio or search for World Talk Radio.
from disasters to cyber threats. It's hard to keep up with the myriad of risks facing businesses today. Risk Partners Alliance is a consortium of business and technology consultants whose focus is to identify and mitigate threats to the operation of your business, your critical systems, infrastructure, and information security. We create comprehensive business continuity programs, including risk assessment, emergency preparedness, crisis management planning, technical disaster recovery, and information security services. We provide hands-on crisis leadership team evaluation and training through scenario-based practices. Our experts are widely sought-after speakers because of their passion, excellence, and unique training methods, and have a 30-year track record of providing risk management and recovery services to a variety of industries. Our proven plans have been put into action in every major disaster since 1989. Find us online at riskpa.com or email info@riskpa.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. You deserve some rest from worry. Contact us so we can help.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. If you have a question or comment about the program, please send us an email to info@riskpa.com. Again, that's info@riskpa.com. Or follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. Now, back to the program.
Hey, welcome back to the show, everyone. This is Pam Hill. I'm here with Mike Roach, and we are talking about his fascinating book on mass killers. So, Mike, I read some research by Professor Jim Mihalik from Boston College, and he did quite a bit of research on feminine and masculine norms. So, you know, how young men and young women perceive, you know, femininity or masculinity. And one of the things that he actually found is that younger men now associate masculinity with violence in a way that they never did before. And so, and I don't mean like the kind of violence of somebody's attacking my family and I have to go into primal protect mode. I mean, acting out of violence and associating that with being a man. And I'm just kind of curious what you think about, as a person who's studied human behavior. I mean, what do you think about that? Is that a trend that you've noticed in younger people? Does it have to do with video games? And what do you think?
You know, it could do with the video games. That there has been some research that, you know, there's an increase in aggression associated with video games. Stanford University did one with students out in the San Francisco Bay Area. And then I believe it was Ohio State conducted one. It was a very small sample of, if I remember correctly, like about 75 students over in France, and found that their aggression had increased after playing, you know, a certain duration of video games. The big question is, well, how long does that last before it starts to dissipate? If you unplug, does the tendencies begin to dissipate? Or how long does it stay in the system that it keeps you amped up? You know, it's kind of hard to say. You know, the thing is, you have people, you know, millions of people are playing video games on a daily basis. And, you know, probably 99.9% of the youth are playing video games of some sort. And the overwhelming majority of them will never engage in a violent act. And a lot of it comes down to what the coping skills are. And, but, you know, I think the one thing that you can probably hang your hat on is that narcissism has significantly increased in the culture today. And when you look at it, you know, statistics say that, you know, one out of 16 individuals suffer from narcissistic personality disorder. And it runs about 25% in college-age students. So, you know, and the thing with narcissists are that, you know, they have a certain sense of entitlement, elitism, and, you know, an expectation of what they anticipate being their due reward or their trophy hunt in life, so to speak. And, but when they reach failure in those efforts, A lot of times we haven't been able to properly prepare them for dealing with adversity in life. And narcissists are known that when they are faced with adversaries or adversity, that they become very aggressive as a result.
Huh, now, that's really
William
interesting.
William Pollack is a professor at Harvard, and he's done significant studies on, in fact, he's written a great book called Real Boys, and really drills down into the psyche of the difference between males and females. And this, so to speak, what he refers to as a boy code, and then also, the mask of masculine bravado, which, I love that term. That's a great term. And it really is that, boys, have to keep that stiff upper lip, the stoicism, and, have to march out a bravado mask out there to kind of cover up for any inadequacies that they might have. And the studies indicate that boys have much lower self-esteem than females.
At a certain age, or is that the case pretty much across the board?
I think it's pretty much across the board, in especially for adolescents.
I've read that. I read about half of that book. I just haven't had a chance to finish it yet. It is an absolutely fascinating book. And as somebody with two young great nephews, I'm going to be buying that book for both of their parents, because I just think this is an absolutely fantastic and fascinating topic. And just we could do a whole hour just on why and how this society has become so narcissistic. I mean, you ask anybody our age, and they're, 100% of them will say, what's wrong with America? It's everybody is in it for themselves. It really, truly is the me generation now, in a way that,
Which is the title of another great book out there written by Professor Jeannie Twenge at San Diego State University, too.
So, interesting. I'll have to read that for sure.
Yeah, it's really a fascinating book into the narcissistic personality.
So let me ask you this, since I'm asking you about all these kind of, to my mind, these are all sort of motivations. These go to why people have isolated, themselves to the point where they can, commit these kinds of violence. And I always wonder about social media. So, it's like, I have 1,000 friends on Facebook and, 2,000 followers on Twitter. I must be a really social person. But the fact is that with social media comes isolation, because we're doing this, when we're sitting at home, or when we're sitting on a train or something like that. And so I just always wonder, is that we really have become more isolated, not less isolated, as a nation. And do you think that plays a part in our proclivity for acting out violently towards each other?
I would agree that as a culture, we've embraced almost a virtual world of existence, where we submerse ourselves in the computer world. And like you said, everybody's striving for more likes and more followers on Twitter and whatnot. The one thing I see coming from that is that sometimes it's hard to get a real read on an individual, because they do submerse themselves in this, in fact, you have an entire society set up, the second life, where, individuals are able to essentially submerse themselves in an alternate society and, create and interact on their own terms. And it becomes a fictional world, but it's their real world that they live within. And, it becomes more difficult for them to interact with others. The one problem is that you have some of them that become so ingrained in the computer world, so to speak, that they have difficulty interacting with others. And then you also have some individuals, like you take an Adam Lanza, for example, who essentially, or even the Navy Yard shooter, Aaron Alexis, both of them, I term them as digital hermits, that, despite their age, that they really had a minimal existence in social media, which again kind of, you know, is a warning sign in itself that, hey, wait a second, you're not engaging with friends on Facebook. And then you also have to look at what is the depth of those true friendships? Are they really having true social interaction with these individuals, and what are the discussions of topics and whatnot? So.
Yeah, it's just I just always wonder about isolation. That just can't be good. It's certainly not good for the soul.
And the thing is, with the isolates, like you look at Sung-Hee Cho with Virginia Tech, you know, he was so locked down that really nobody knew much about him. I mean, he had no interaction with his suite mates, minimal interaction with other students and faculty. Even his parents, he was removed from them. And the same with Adam Lanza, that nobody really knew him outside of his mother. So unless she was willing to ring the bell of alarm to say that this person needs help, the rest of the community wouldn't necessarily know that there's something going on. That there was a shooting over at the university, or a near shooting at the University of Central Florida last year. And again, it was a student that kind of like Cho, where he had no interaction with his suite mates. They didn't even know him. He lived in a dorm room with three other suite mates, and they really had no conversations with him his entire time. And nobody really knew him until that night when he pulled the fire alarm and then had a gun jam. And as a result, was unable to carry forth with what he had planned was going to be, you know, a high body count.
Right. Do you think, and this is kind of a loaded question, but I'm going to ask it anyway,
because you do
address it to an extent in your book. Do you think that the decline in spiritual meditation, you know, it used to be everybody goes to church and now not so much. Do you think that that plays a role in the level of violence in America?
You know, this is what I'll say about this, is that of the individuals that I've interviewed, I've not found any of them, you know, spiritually energized, so to speak. And, you know, I think those who can find, you know, peace through whether it's meditation, prayer, or attendance at church with a higher authority, have stronger emotional coping skills to deal with the adversities that we all face in life. Now, I'm sure the atheist will strongly disagree with that position. But what I would say also is that those that are comfortable with their religious position, whether they're absolute non-believers or they're true believers, is that you have less inner conflict. And, you know, that there was, and you can also look at some that, you know, become so rigid within their religious beliefs that they can't let go, and that they have this considerable internal strife. And there was a case in New Jersey back in the 70s, an individual by the name of John List. And List, if you look at his picture, he looks like an accountant, because he was. And but he had lost his job. He was living in this this huge home, and basically his mother was living in an upstairs apartment, and he was kind of living off of some of her charity. And but he was and he was kind of a different individual. He was seen mowing his yard in a suit, and but he was having problems with his family, as his wife was an alcoholic. One of his children had been caught smoking marijuana. He was concerned about her conduct, and as far as he was concerned, the entire family was getting ready to go to hell. And as a result, in order to save them from going to hell, he decided to kill them all, which he did.
Oh,
and then so it was three children, his wife, and then his mother. And then he escaped for, I want to say it was maybe like 18 years before finally the authorities caught up with him. And Connie Chung had asked him about that, about, you know, well, why didn't you commit suicide with them? And he said, well, that would have been a sin.
Oh, my goodness. Isn't that something?
It would have been sinful for him to commit suicide, but not a sin to kill them, because he felt, in his viewpoint, that he was saving them from damnation, and that he will join them again in heaven at some point in time.
Wow. We have to go to break now, Mike,
sure.
And when we come back, I want to get into a little bit more in terms of motivation of people that commit targeted violence. So this is Pam Hill. I'm here with Mike Roche, and we'll be right back.
We're always talking business.
Talk to an expert.
Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network. From disasters to cyber threats, it's hard to keep up with the myriad of risks facing businesses today. Risk Partners Alliance is a consortium of business and technology consultants whose focus is to identify and mitigate threats to the operation of your business, your critical systems, infrastructure, and information security. We create comprehensive business continuity programs, including risk assessment, emergency preparedness, crisis management planning, technical disaster recovery, and information security services. We provide hands-on crisis leadership team evaluation and training through scenario-based practices. Our experts are widely sought-after speakers because of their passion, excellence, and unique training methods, and have a 30-year track record of providing risk management and recovery services to a variety of industries. Our proven plans have been put into action in every major disaster since 1989. Find us online at riskpa.com or email info@riskpa.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. You deserve some rest from worry. Contact us so we can help.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You are tuned in to Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. If you have a question or comment about the program, please send us an email to info@riskpa.com. Again, that's info@riskpa.com. Or follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. Now, back to the program.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. This is Pam Hill, and I'm here with the fabulous Mike Roche, and we are talking about mass killers. And, Mike, I'd like to go now to the profile of a person acting out targeted violence. What's the profile, if you can sum it up? I don't know that you could, but if you can.
Sure. We hand this out to everybody so that they can, you know, post this up on their refrigerators in case anybody happens to come in that meets this profile. And that being anybody that's between the ages of 12 and 88, educated and predominantly angry white males. That's the essence of the profile, so to speak. And most of them are all in a state of despair with significant loss or facing one, and with a history of suicide attempts and impaired coping skills.
Yeah, one of these that had happened since the last time you and I talked was a woman, and I remember being really surprised by that. I can't recall which one. Honestly, there have been so many since the last time you and I talked,
which wasn't that long ago. I mean, anytime I ever give this class, I mean, it's difficult to keep up with it.
Yeah, I would think. Okay, so now here's this is a curiosity for me. Do people that are going to act out violently generally make threats directly to their intended victims?
Typically, no. And the Secret Service conducted a study of assassins and near what we refer to as near lethal attackers, those that are on the path to or have moved down the path towards violence. And what they found was none of the assassins had ever intimated a threat directly to the target or to law enforcement, and only 1/10 of the near attackers had made any sort of threats. And Park Dietz, who's a noted forensic psychologist, had found kind of the same thing as far as the letter writers to both Hollywood celebrities and members of Congress as well.
Interesting. You must have some real stories to tell, 22 years on the Secret Service, about some of the follow-up you had to do, I can imagine. Now, So my next question is, does the way in which the threat is actually delivered ever mean that it should be taken more seriously? And I realize that all threats are supposed to be taken seriously.
Correct.
But do some kind of escalate a little bit more? So in other words, I do it face to face. I send somebody a letter. I tell my coworker I'm going to kill my boss. I do it on Facebook. Or if it's done by intimate partners, I mean, are any of those kind of at going up to the top of the list worry-wise?
You know, I look at every threat that ever came in as being potentially a viable threat, and you have to vet each one and check and see that the validity of each one. I will say that, again, from the Secret Service study, that about two-thirds of those that were studied had written or spoken of their intentions with others. So that there was this verbal leakage that occurred, or literary leakage is another term that I use, with their writings. And in the school shooters, it was even more pronounced, where you had 81% of them that shared it with other students. And there was a case up in Bethel, Alaska, with a student by the name of Evan Ramsey, where so many of the other students were aware of what was about to occur that they actually gathered on a mezzanine looking down, and one brought their camera to photograph the shooting. And, you know, most of them, when they were asked, said, well, I didn't really think he was going to do it, or I thought he was joking, and, you know, those type of statements. And there was a similar case in Santee, California, at a school. A student by the name of Andy Williams, the shooter, not the singer, he had, again, was, there were actually, in that case, two adults had overheard him talking about his plans. One just dismissed it and never addressed it. The other one actually asked him and said, you know, I hope this isn't going to be a Columbine situation. And he said, oh, no, I'm just joking, and dismissed it. But, you know, he landed up engaging in a shooting in there at the school.
I'm here with Mike Roach again. And Mike, I'm kind of curious, is there a different pathology or even an ideology for people that target, say, a school versus famous people, politicians? I mean, are they thinking different things, or is it usually against a, you know, specific person or organization?
Well, yeah, and I think you're exactly right there. It's basically, you know, it comes down to the target selection and the symbolism behind that target. But the mindset is very similar when you look at workplace violence, school shooters, the public shooters, even, you know, celebrity or presidential type assassins as well.
No, that's really interesting stuff. This is one of the things I really liked about your book, because I think it goes into the different kinds of things that motivated a lot of different folks who did targeted violence. So it's a very, very interesting book. You tell a lot of great stories. In general, what kind of motivates these people at a high level? And I know everyone is different, but what really motivates people that commit targeted violence as a general rule, if you could make them?
Yeah, I would say fame is obviously one of the more paramount motivations. And, you know, people sit there and say fame. I mean, you know, that sounds so bizarre, but it really is. And it was a great term that I heard, I read about in Catherine Ramsland, and she said she didn't come up with it, so I don't know who it was, but it's called the rehearsal fantasy, and I saw this, I was watching the movie, I think it was Killing Kennedy, and Lee Harvey Oswald was going through these rehearsal fantasies, essentially, you know, like what a writer would do, thinking, well, Oprah Winfrey's going to interview me, and here I'm going to be interviewed on national TV concerning, or the understanding that, hey, I will be elevated to such a high level that there's going to be an exclamation mark next to my name from this point forward. And, you know, Mark Chapman, who killed John Lennon, had said, you know, the reason he actually had a list of multiple targets, but what he said was that these people were famous and he wanted to be famous as well. And Arthur Bremer, who had shot George Wallace, initially was targeting President Nixon, and he wrote a book called The Assassin's Diary. And in his diary, he noted or lamented at the fact that he was changing his target to George Wallace, and he was thinking, well, if there's some international disaster, a storm, or somewhere in the world, you know, I'll be buried back on, you know, the metro section, and who's going to care whether George Wallace was killed or not? So you can see that this is a huge motivation for them, is to elevate their platform, and, you know, everybody's going to remember who I was. Another factor, of course, is suicide, and we've seen that, you know, two-thirds of them have had previous history of suicide attempts. These individuals don't just snap. I mean, it's not like they're sitting there mixing mojitos one night and deciding, hey, you know, I'm going to go out and conduct a mass killing. And, but, you know, Catherine Ramsland again came out with a great term called coerced suicide, where these people feel that there's nothing left in life, that, that they need to make one final statement as they exit life. And, often that's associated with, revenge. Which, you know, you can probably look at the Aurora, Colorado shooting as being a form of revenge back at the university to demonstrate. James Holmes can sit there and say, this is to show you people that I was pretty smart and you made a huge mistake kicking me out of school. Mm-hmm. And then probably the last one is to try to bring attention to a perceived grievance. You don't see that quite as often. I would say Christopher Dorner, the former LAPD police officer, would fall into that, where he was trying to, you know, he was a very narcissistic, a wound collector, where he held on to grievances throughout his entire life, beginning in the first grade. And you sit there and say, who does that? But he did. And then you look at it and say that, for him, he was trying to bring awareness to the racial insensitivity of the police department and his discrimination, his perceived discrimination.
Now, we only have about 3 minutes before break, but you use the term in the book, what I think is really important for people to understand, especially if they know somebody who all of a sudden their behavior starts changing. You call it a negative emotional vortex. Again, we only have about 3 minutes, but explain what that is and why that's so important to understand.
Absolutely, and I think this is really the crux of the matter for a great number of these individuals, is this accumulation of negative baggage in their life, that they feel absolutely trapped in a downward spiral, and they feel that there's no means of escape. And you have to look at the world from their viewpoint, from what I refer to as their flip-flops. And you know, it's not about me, how I look at the world. I have to put myself in their flip-flops, their shoes, and look at the world from their perspective as to what's going on. And, you know, Luke Woodham, who is a shooter in Pearl River, Mississippi at the school there, you know, he said his rampage was not a cry for help, but a scream in sheer agony.
Oh.
And, you know, he felt he had no choice as to what he was going to do. Amy Bishop, who's a professor at the University of Alabama at Huntsville, went into a meeting and shot a number of her fellow professors. And it came down to she was about ready to lose tenure at the university. And for her, this was her entire life. She was highly narcissistic. And, you know, for her, she was looking at, hey, what am I going to do? Am I going to have to now go back to teaching high school biology, which is not a bad thing. And I salute all the teachers. But for her, this was incomprehensible. She had prepared her whole life for this. And the same thing for James Holmes, now being rejected by the university. So.
Right. No, interesting. Well, Mike, we have to go to break, but when we come back, I'd like to talk about some attack-related behaviors that you mentioned in the book. So this is Pam Hill. I'm here with Mike Roach, and we'll be right back.
Find out what's happening on the Voice America Talk Radio Network by keeping up with us on Twitter. You can find us at Voice America TRN.
From disasters to cyber threats, it's hard to keep up with the myriad of risks facing businesses today. Risk Partners Alliance is a consortium of business and technology consultants whose focus is to identify and mitigate threats to the operation of your business, your critical systems, infrastructure, and information security. We create comprehensive business continuity programs, including risk assessment, emergency preparedness, crisis management planning, technical disaster recovery, and information security services. We provide hands-on crisis leadership team evaluation and training through scenario-based practices. Our experts are widely sought-after speakers because of their passion, excellence, and unique training methods, and have a 30-year track record of providing risk management and recovery services to a variety of industries. Our proven plans have been put into action in every major disaster since 1989. Find us online at riskpa.com or email info@riskpa.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. You deserve some rest from worry. Contact us so we can help.
We're always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. If you have a question or comment about the program, please send us an email to info@riskpa.com. Again, that's info@riskpa.com. Or follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. Now, back to the program.
Hey, welcome back to the show, everyone. This is Pam Hill, and I'm here with Mike Roach, and we are talking about mass killers. Mike, to what extent, if any, does mental illness play into a threat going from ideation to actuality?
I think it's a huge factor. What we found was that in this Secret Service study was that about 80% of the presidential assassins had a history of mental illness, but only 29% had sought treatment in the year prior to the event. But E. Fuller Torrey wrote a great book, and what he advocates is that only 1% of the mentally ill are dangerous. And I've been in and out of mental facilities for, 15 years and spent, countless hours interviewing these individuals. And, for the most part, most of them were, and I've never had a physical confrontation with any of the ones that I ever spoke with. So, just because somebody has a mental illness doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to be a danger, but you again have to look at the world from their prism and see how they're viewing the world. And like in the instance of Aaron Alexis, the Navy Yard shooter, where he had such paranoid behavior that he has an occurrence with an elderly couple in an airport in Norfolk, Virginia. And one of them, to give you an idea of how elderly, one was in a wheelchair being pushed by the other. But somehow he thinks that these people have now sent people after him, and then there's microwaves being beamed in through his hotel rooms, and he's having difficulty functioning. But what we want to get down to is, are they so incapacitated by their mental illness that you don't have to worry about it? And like there was one individual I remember interviewing, the guy could not logisticate himself out of the urine-soaked recliner that he was sitting in. So, he could espouse threats all day long, but he wasn't capable of doing anything. Meanwhile, you take somebody like an Aaron Alexis that is more functioning and can, hold logical thoughts long enough to actually execute a plan. And that's what it comes down to. And Adam Lanza would fall into that same category that, obviously had some significant mental health issues, but was able to at least plan what he wanted to do.
Now, in the book, you discuss in the again in the Secret Service studies that attackers will display at least one attack-related behavior before they actually commit violence. Can you describe what those are and why it's important to understand those, just from a purely investigative standpoint?
Sure. The one thing that really stands out is that many of them have an interest or an obsession with assassinations. And again, you can look at Adam Lanza. He, continuing to go back, but he's such a good demonstration of this was, here was an individual that had, you know, from some media accounts, a spreadsheet that was, you know, 7 feet long that entailed over 500 different shootings where he had taken detailed notes on them. And, you know, we've seen this over and over again, where, you know, people will actually conduct some significant research, you know, because, you know, they're looking to be successful. They want to get away with it, so they start reading it. How did somebody else do it? How did they plan? What kind of weapons they used? And this type of behavior. The other thing is that they will develop an attack plan. And sometimes it doesn't have to be overly complicated. But in the case of, like, the Columbine shooters, that was a year in planning and was extremely detailed. I mean, even down to the point that they had decided they were going to practice gearing up with their equipment and weapons inside the car. And then I thought, you know, most adults wouldn't think of doing that, but that shows that to the level of planning, and that they had practiced hand signals with each other, and, you know, it kept detailed notes on what the projected census was in the cafeteria, that it, you know, at 11:15 there would be 500 students, which was the high water mark for the census within the cafeteria. And they were hoping to detonate their explosives to take out the 500 students. Fortunately, they had some malfunctions with the devices, and they didn't detonate like they were expected to. Two others, or to approach or to conduct some sort of surveillance of the location, or to attempt to penetrate security. And we saw, like, with Cho had practiced with chains on the doors. There was some evidence that perhaps he had tried to chain the doors to the dormitory the week before. And, you know, and I would figure that James Holmes and Aurora had probably gone out that back door to check to see whether there was alarms on the door.
Right. Oh, that's just so frightening to even think about it. So we just have a few minutes before I want to make sure you have a chance to tell people how to get a hold of you. So we just have a couple minutes. But if you could break it down for a human resources person or, you know, someone on a threat assessment team, what are some of the key red flags we should all be concerned about? So you notice this in a coworker or an employee. What are the things that would worry you the most to see?
You know, what I'm looking for is, for those individuals, when others are expressing concerns about the person's behavior, and then, you know, those closest to him saying, hey, you know, he's really acting bizarre, or he's being very threatening. You know, there was a case with a guy by the name of Doug Williams at Lockheed Martin in Mississippi, shot 14 of his coworkers. And when it happened, everybody said, well, we knew it was him because he was just mad at the world and had become a constant problem. And then there was a shooting up in Minneapolis at Accent Signage, Andrew Engeldinger. And again, same type of situation where there was this pattern of concerning behavior amongst the others. And he was isolated from them. He was confrontational with them, difficult to get along. And again, you have to look at the world from their flip-flops and, you know, examine whether they're experiencing this emotional negative vortex. Are they on the verge of being fired? What is their home life on? Changes in behavior from their norm. And quite often, domestic discourse will often spill over into the workplace as well. And just because things may be fine at work, they may have an estranged spouse that's targeting them that will come to the workplace, and the violence will spill out there at the work. So,
right. So it sounds like we can't do the old HR standby of, you know, we've got to be three steps removed from everything and, you know, be politically correct. I mean, you have to get to know people around you and find out what's going on with them. It seems like that these, you know, like you said before, people don't just snap. There's usually some kind of behavioral something going in, you know, to this. So I think that that's a really, really important lesson, you know, at the end of the day for this. So, Mike, I could have spent twice as much time.
The one thing I want to add is that I want the employers to understand that they have a duty to warn, and it's, you know, quite often, you know, it's a legal tightrope that they're walking. You know, you don't want to be sued by the one, but at the same time, if you don't do anything and something happens, then you're going to be sued by everybody else.
Exactly. Very, very important point. So, Mike, can you just quickly tell people how they can get your book? Everybody should read this book. It's an absolutely fascinating book, and get a hold of you.
Absolutely. Mass Killers, you can get that through Amazon, and then you can also do a digital download both via Amazon as well as Barnes & Noble via your Nook. And then the paperback itself is available on Amazon. And you can get through to me at MikeRoche.com, and it's R-O-C-H-E, the Irish spelling, and or through ProtectiveThreat.com. ProtectiveThreat.com.
Well, thanks again for joining us today to discuss this topic. To the rest of you, thanks for listening in. Join us next week as we are going to discuss how to recognize the signs and guard against business fraud. Until then, remember, fear is negotiable, but only through planning, training, and preparation. There is no other way. Safe travels, everyone, and thanks again, Mike.
Thank you so much, Pam.
Thank you for joining us this week for Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. We hope you'll tune in again next Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time for another edition with host Pamela Hill on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll identify more of the best practices in business survival then.
The information and ideas presented on this show are for informational purposes only. Please consult a business continuity, security, or disaster recovery professional before implementing any plans or ideas discussed on this show. The implementation of any protocol is at the sole discretion and responsibility of our listeners.